Hello and welcome to the March 11th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I am Anthony Bardaway. I'm here with my colleague, Romeo Kukratsky.
Hi, all.
So our last episode was an interview, and we didn't do any news updates during it, so this is a bit of a catch-up episode for all things that happened over the last few weeks, and there has been quite a bit. But as usual, we'll start out with our combat update, starting off with the less changed areas, we'll call them, and then ending on, of course, the main story, as it always is, Bakhmut. So if you look at the northern end of the line, the Russians have been trying to make their way back to Kupiansk, of going up to the Oskol River and trying to work their way down it. Now, there hasn't been many updates in this since the last 2 weeks or so. But again, because this is a catch-up episode, we have to bring it up. They were able to capture one or two small villages, but have otherwise been stopped along that axis, and they're currently trying to cross the Oskol to no real effect. Going a bit south of there, at the Svatova-Karmina regions, again, not much has changed since our last news update in these areas. The line around them has mostly been stable. The Russians in their spring offensive were able to capture some of the forested area around Karmina that Ukraine was previously able to make gains into. But again, not much change. Avdiivka and Vuhledar, these are the two offensives that Russia has been the least successful with, in that not only are they not making any real gains, but they've been taking extremely heavy casualties. And we talked about this in the last episode, and it's the same situation. Russians trying to make some kind of charge across empty farmland, getting blown up with artillery, and being driven back. That is still the story now, as it was the last time we talked about it. Marinka, this is one that caught my eye because someone on Wikipedia actually edited the Wikipedia entry for Marinka as saying it was a city in Ukraine, which is a good description of the fighting that has been happening there. Marinka used to be called part of what was called the gray zone, kind of the area in between the Ukrainian and Russian lines during the Donbas stage of the war, starting in 2014-2015, where there was some of these areas in between this no man's land that was inhabited by people who lived in this kind of bizarre existence. You can read the book Gray Bees to hear one description of that, a quite good book. But Marinka was directly on the front line, in that the front line ran through the town itself, and there were some times when it was pushed one way or the other, and other times where several blocks of the town were in this no man's land gray zone. But now the town is basically completely flattened. Recent footage, aerial footage of the area shows that there is seemingly not a single building still standing, and the fighting is out of these collapsed basements and dugout holes. The Russians have been able to advance slightly forward in Marinka, but there's really not much to take for starters, and again, not much forward movement. Which, of course, brings us to Bakhmut, which is in a very desperate situation. Now, in the east of the city, the Russians have captured much of the private house region to the east of the Bakhmutka River. The front line is more or less the Bakhmutka River at the moment, though it is a rather shallow river. It is possible to make raids across it without terribly much difficulty. So there is some back and forth still. Some Russians have reportedly made beachhead on the opposite side of the river, then got pushed back again. It is not exactly the Dnipro. So this eastern section of the city, where much of the direct fighting has been taking place over the course of the last 2 months or so, that is now in Russian hands. To the south of the city, The Russians have not made terribly many gains. They have continued their attacks on Chasiv Yar and Ivanovka to not much effect. The front line in the south is largely unchanged, except for one salient that sticks forward pretty close to what would be one of the roads to take to exit the city. And then on the north is where most of their advances have been made. Now, the Ukrainians have been able to flood a river on the northern side of the city, which seems to have contributed to great extent to stopping the Russian advance from north to south, because that line seems to have stayed mostly the same for the last week or so. But they are expanding their control over the area to the north of that in order to make it less vulnerable to Ukrainian counterattack. Now, altogether, this has led to a situation where Bakhmut is stuck into a very worrying salient where both of the roads that could be used to retreat from the city are perilously close to the Russian lines and are within easy shot of Russian artillery fire. Many commentators, both in the military and the civilian worlds, have been very worried that Ukraine is being too slow to withdraw from Bakhmut, considering these very dire circumstances and the level of casualties and destruction that is taking place there. But it seems as though President Zelensky had a meeting with some of the top generals, including Zaluzhny, probably the most respected Ukrainian general, and they have made the decision to stay and defend the city, that it is still possible to hold the Russians off there within their own calculations, whatever that may be. I feel like their judgment has been correct enough in the past to believe them, but it's still very worrying. Now, on the Russian side, there has been some communications by Prigozhin, the leader of the Wagner group, saying that they are running out of ammo again and may have to pause their offensives, but many of their duties have been taken up by the Russian army anyway, so it's difficult to judge what immediate effect that may have in the fighting. Prigozhin also said that he was very much worried about the Ukrainian counterattack coming from four different angles around Bakhmut, and was therefore cautious about pushing too deep into Bakhmut city center because of that, of it leaving him vulnerable to an attack from behind. Now, is this true? Who's to say? There is Ukrainian buildup around Chasiv Yar, at least, and it seems as though there is at least a rumor that there could be a Ukrainian counterattack in order to relieve the siege of Bakhmut, but we don't know. The city is closed off right now. There is a more or less tight press blackout. Updates from within the city are very slow and contain very little information. We just don't know the situation there in any great detail. So in our final bit of this combat update, we have to talk about a rather troubling video that the Russians spread online in the past days. It showed a Ukrainian soldier who apparently, from the looks on the video, was either in a trench or, to me, it looked like he had dug his own grave. He had stated Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine, and then was killed in a hail of gunfire by his Russian captors. The identity of this soldier, there are still conflicting reports on. Ukrainian Central Command is saying that it is Timofey Shidura, while the Northern Territorial Defense says that the soldier's name was Alexander Matsievsky, a member of the Territorial Defense from Chernihiv. It is impossible to say exactly which one of these men it was, as both were missing and most likely taken captive. But either way, this resulted in an outcry of support on Ukrainian social media of people saying Slava Ukraini as a form of solidarity with this man, whatever his name may be, and his family. Because it was seen as the reason, perhaps, of him being executed, or perhaps just because it was a show of defiance in the face of Russian fascist abuses of staying true to the country and declaring his truth and what he believed was right. In our next story, it is still something of a combat update, but something wrapped in many layers of conspiracy theory, even cloud of war. It just is a very difficult thing to say what exactly happened here. So last week, there was a raid on a small village in the Bryansk Oblast of Russia, immediately on the other side of the Ukrainian border. And I would say immediately, I mean, like, you could walk across the street into Ukraine from here. Initial reports said that there were several explosions in the city. The Russian press was making it out to be like there was a full-scale invasion of Russia happening by some kind of elite unit. But the people who took credit for it was this group known as the Russian Volunteer Corps, a group of far-right Russian activists who had fled Russia for Ukraine in 2014-2015 and became somewhat adjacent to the Azov movement in Ukraine. Now, the Volunteer Corps, it's hard to say what exactly they've been up to lately, as they do not have official sanction in the military. But it seems as though that their purpose for this attack was to something similar to the idea of like anarchist propaganda of the deed or accelerationism, trying to jolt Russians out of their stupor and encourage further violence within the countries, further uprisings. The proof that it was these people, and not only did they claim it, on video from within this village, they posted a video of themselves saying what they were doing there, who they were, and on this video was Denis Kapustin, Alexei Levkin, two people who are rather famous within this milieu. They are established quantities. And a similar unit made up of people who were associated with them had done another raid close by in December, although many of the members of this unit were killed at that time. So to me, this looks pretty concrete that it was this group and they carried it out for the reasons that they said they did. But Romeo, you were skeptical. So could you explain some of your skepticism about what happened? And I have more follow-up information after.
Yeah. Well, first off, whenever anything happens in Russia, there is always quite a bit of fog around the truth of the situation. And when we come to something like a Russian far-right Nazi group supposedly staging a quote-unquote raid into Russian territory, where the motives and the objectives are both entirely unclear. As Michael Colborn wrote on Twitter, what is this? What did this op achieve? A combat unit led by an infamous alleged criminal neo-Nazi who's banned from most of Europe, doing PR-focused things that could give Putin even more BS rhetorical justification for Russian attacks. Now, Michael Colborn's instinct is that it is in agreement with yours, Anthony, that the raid happened despite the fact that it's the stupid. But one of the pillars that I always rely upon whenever I'm analyzing uncertain events is the age-old principle of cui bono, or who benefits. And as Michael lays out, the op doesn't benefit anyone except for Russia. It is incredibly unlikely that seeing a bunch of dudes in armor and holding rifles holding up a flag near some village is going to inspire some kind of armed revolt against the Russian military. It's very unclear how they could have penetrated the Ukrainian-Russian border without support from one or the other side. And unlike earlier raids conducted by similar groups into that portion of Russia, there was no reported combat. There are no casualties. And despite the fact that these borders are normally porous, they are pretty well defended now. And it's hard to imagine that the Russians would simply not notice a number of pickups or SUVs, probably up armored, crossing the border, carrying a dozen or so guys, and then coming back without any knowledge, reconnaissance, or fire. Given all of that, I find it difficult to believe this was carried out either by an independent group, because mind you, in order to simply get to that point of the front, they would need to necessarily liaise with Ukrainian military authorities, because most of that territory is unavailable to civilians. In addition, they would have to liaise with Ukrainian intelligence, with reconnaissance. And as Michael pointed out, there is zero benefit for Ukraine in an act like this. Kubono says it's the Russians, and that is what I am inclined to think, unless proven otherwise.
Yeah, and the point of it drawing attention to these Russian neo-Nazis, essentially, in Ukraine, it buys into Russian propaganda about Ukraine being full of Nazis, and that is one of the main things I saw after this was people saying, who were not aware of them beforehand, saying, oh, isn't it convenient how like those Ukrainians have all of Russia's Nazis too, which is a nonsense claim, but it is one that plays well into the Russian propaganda narrative, and it did throw some gasoline on that fire.
And I do also want to note that of the group that allegedly made this raid, one of the figures that was easily identifiable on the photos, and by the way, all of the members of this group are easily identifiable in the photos. They didn't make any effort to blank out, for example, their faces, which you would assume any halfway decent or even existing partisan group of any kind would be not to advertise their identities to the enemy power, which they did not. They were easily identified. And one of the people that was identified is a Russian neo-Nazi known as Denis Kapustin. So Kapustin is known to be involved with Azov, but there is some nuance here, and that nuance comes in the deep infiltration of the Russian Federal Security Service, the FSB, into far-right movements in Russia and Ukraine. I'm sure it comes to no one's surprise that not only did the FSB materially and financially assist far-right movements prior to 2014, but Azov continued to have problems with FSB infiltrators well into 2018, 2019. In fact, there was a well-known Azov-connected neo-Nazi Belarusian this time called Sergei Korotkich, who was later discovered to be an infiltrator for the FSB. So the FSB is well acquainted with the far right and neo-Nazi spheres in Russia and Ukraine. You might as well just assume basically everywhere that is one of their fortes. And we already have proven instances of the FSB using those connections. And I'd also like to note that in my experience, neo-Nazis are not the most neo-Nazis are not known for their integrity and strength of character. If they were, they wouldn't be neo-Nazis. And as a result, it is trivially believable for me to buy into Kapustin being paid money to stage some photo op that makes Ukraine look bad. So, TLDR, I'm almost positive the Bryansk so-called raid was a Russian operation to discredit Ukraine. one of the many, many, many that they have attempted to pull off during this war and previously.
Well, we've presented a thesis and the antithesis. So now I want to give a synthesis of what these theories could be.
We are dialectical materialists here on the Ukraine Without Hype Pod.
Yeah, of course. So what I've kind of settled on, based on very little hard evidence, just thinking about it, really, which means ultimately nothing. But here's what I think happened. This group, as we said, is definitely infiltrated. So what I'm assuming happened was that this was a legitimate raid by this Russian group who wanted to do this accelerationist activity within Russia.
We will not be explaining accelerationism on this pod. That would take an entire episode and be outside the scope of discussion.
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile, because they were infiltrated or had some kind of contact with the Russian security services, either knowingly, purposefully, or accidentally, they let it be known to Russian security services that this was going to happen, and they allowed it to happen. They had forewarning, and either because they saw it as we explained, a way for Russia to boost their PR narratives, or some other reason, who knows, they allowed it to happen. Now, it also seems as though it's possible, I'm giving this so many qualifiers, that they were under the impression that it would be a larger attack than it turned out to be. And we can kind of look at Putin's speech afterwards as proof of this part of it, at least. The initial reports about this raid were talking about them basically burning this village to the ground. They were talking about massive firefights. It was a huge battle that was going on after Russia was invaded by the Ukrainians. And it seems as though they believed that to be the case because of whatever communication that was occurring. But then when Putin was giving his speech, he really just kind of downplayed it. Like, oh, it was no big deal. Like, they initially had the narrative prepared that it was this huge attack. Then when it turned out not to be, they kind of had to shift gears last minute.
Yeah, there were initially rumors from Russian sources that these so-called fighters had taken hostages and held up a bus full of school children and all of this evil, evil, bad Ukrainian Nazi stuff that Ukrainian Nazis absolutely do. Hold school buses full of children hostage, though. As Anthony mentioned, when it turned out that the raid was a giant nothing burger and basically just a photo op, the Russian government had to do some quick somersaulting narratively to keep their train of propaganda running.
Yeah, and I think that the way they initially understood it, they could have kept telling that lie, but Putin instead downplayed it. Instead, they realized that was going nowhere, which is something that Russians don't often do. They usually like to stick for a lie for as long as they can. But in this case, Putin called it terrorism and kind of seemed frustrated at his information handlers for kind of misleading him, was the impression that I got from it.
And Putin also went on a very strange rant, kind of semi-rant about that these so-called terrorists were trying to somehow destroy or rewrite Russian history. To be honest, it was a very strange speech, even by Putin's standards.
Yeah, he's been getting he's always kind of gotten hung up on these bizarre pseudo-historical theories, but it has been getting more and more unhinged with time. I don't know if that's a sign of actual cognitive decline that's happening or what. But in the follow-up, this Russian group, or this Russian dissident group anyway, did launch another raid closer to Sumy into Russia with, again, not much to show for it. But an entirely separate group of Russian dissidents called the Freedom of Russian Legion were able to blow up a Russian military aircraft in Vladivostok, a Su-27. They lit it on fire, which is considerably more of a contribution to the war effort than these PR raids. So we kind of presented a lot of different ways to believe what happened here. Pick between them. No solid evidence either way. Something may come out 5 years from now of some leaked file saying what actually happened. But work with what you got.
The fog of war, as ever, is a concealer. Moving on to international news, there are a couple of big ones we're going to cover, notably Moldova and Georgia. But before we get to that, the Chinese have presented their so-called peace plan in order to resolve the Russo-Ukrainian war. And as I would say most savvy commentators expected, the peace plan was a giant nothing burger. Specifically, the Chinese peace plan is a 12-point plan that calls for respecting the sovereignty of all countries, abandoning a Cold War mentality, ceasing hostilities, resuming talks, resolving the humanitarian crisis, protecting POWs, securing nuclear power plants, reducing strategic risks, facilitating grain exports, stopping unilateral sanctions, keeping supply chain stable, and promoting post-conflict reconstruction. In other words, the exact same wishy-washy nothing burgers that China has been making this whole time. Unlike the Chinese government's propaganda, the peace plan is not some genius political document that will somehow end the war tomorrow. It is instead simply a restatement of Chinese principles and positions on basically any conflict in which a Chinese proxy or partner comes into conflict with a Western proxy or partner. Notably, the peace plan does not show, does not provide any way for any of these things to happen. For example, the third point of ceasing hostility simply says that war is bad and everyone should stay calm, which is the genius level of geopolitical maneuvering I expect from one of the world's great economic powers. And this is the case for basically every single point in this so-called peace plan, simply stating a Chinese position and then saying doing the other thing is bad, which is a totally obvious point that absolutely everyone agree with. What this peace plan does not present is any practical roadmap to achieving a single one of their points. As a result, the Ukrainian government simply said in response to China's peace plan that they are grateful for China to be involved in monitoring the crisis and hope that China will take a stronger stand against Russia, while Russians obviously continued on with their inane and delusional claims about NATO escalation and Russophobia. So nothing really happened. China put out a document. It's worthless, and the world moved on.
It was the international relations equivalent of a child making a not fantastic piece of art and handing it to you and you having to act like it was brilliant because they're a child and that's what you do with children. But in this case, it is a global superpower who is heavily invested in the Ukrainian economy, and keeping them happy on some level is still quite important. There is a China factor here, even if it isn't front and center. But it does highlight two of their priorities that they actually do have, in that the 2 points that actually stood out as something regarding actionable qualities is one, being able to, for Ukraine to be able to export grain, because China has a lot of people. They need low food prices. They rely on Africa being somewhat stable. They need low food prices. And those things rely on Ukraine being able to export its grain to the world. And it is something that the international community, even countries that have been somewhat wishy-washy on the war, have been quite involved with in order to make sure that stays productive. And to the issue of nuclear power plants, nobody wants a nuclear power plant to blow up. Everyone is very afraid of that happening. And so China has stepped in to kind of call off the Russian dogs regarding nuclear power plants. And it seems as though at some point the Chinese were able to kind of slap Russia down on threatening to nuke everyone all the time, because at the end of last year, they were doing that quite a lot. And then at some point kind of tapered off, but still not to zero. And the last point here is that there was some confusion of people saying, of people noticing that China was also very much in favor of Ukrainian territorial integrity. Many have thought that this is not sincere on their part. There have been many instances. There was this one fake map that was kind of passed around by basically a Chinese propagandist with no connection to anybody. But this map showed Ukraine bisected, and it claimed that this was put out by the Chinese government. It was not. The Chinese government actually does take territorial integrity quite seriously on account of it having both two separatist movements. Both the Tibetans and the Uyghurs aren't exactly thrilled with Chinese rule, and there have been independence movements in these areas that China does not want to give any form of recognition to. And of course, Taiwan. China says that Taiwan is officially a part of their territory, no matter what the people who live there may think on the topic. So these very firm de jure borders are something China worries about more than almost anything else, which is why they never recognize the Russian annexations. So China, not great, but in this case, they are right for maybe the wrong reasons.
Though, again, none of that eliminates the fact that Chinese companies are helping Russia to smuggle in Western technology to build weapons, whether assisting Russian companies in sanctions avoidance. And while China has not been confirmed to be providing lethal aid to Russia, Russian diplomats have been very hard at work ensuring that China will eventually do so, including sending both Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko there and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in the past few weeks.
Yeah, there has been quite a bit of movement on the possibility that China would provide weapons to Russia, including these suicide drones.
Though, again, I really want to stress there have been no confirmed instances of Chinese manufactured weapons ending up in Russian hands. There have not even been unconfirmed reports of the same, only rumors and murmurings.
Yeah, this is all maybe they're getting ready to do it sometime in the future, maybe. But in response, the United States has already prepared sanctions on some Chinese companies that were more indirectly helping the Russian arms industry. So there's something going on there, but we don't fully know yet. And it seems as though the Chinese are being somewhat conflict avoidant here, because really it does not benefit them much to actually join in on the war. It just doesn't make any sense.
And now on to our last couple of stories of things that actually matter, unlike a do-nothing peace plan. And this is unrest in Moldova and a successful Maidan, we can say by this point, in Georgia. Let's start with Moldova. Anthony, you've tracked the situation quite closely. What can you tell us about it?
Yes. Yeah, so the Moldovan situation here is similar to Ukraine, but in a smaller country. and one that a country that has also been less powerful in its own right. Now, in Moldova, there are the same kind of dynamic where there are pro-European parties and pro-Russian parties, similar to the situation in Ukraine prior to the Maidan. And much like Ukraine prior to the Maidan, these pro-Russian political parties were pretty much completely controlled by these oligarchs and existed largely as a way to legalize money laundering. So one of these pro-Russian oligarchic politicians is named Alan Shor. Now, Alan, as you might be able to tell from his first name there, is from Israel. He was born in Israel to Moldovan immigrant parents and came back to Moldova in order to get into business. And from there, became one of the country's richest people. And as one of the country's richest people, he has been kind of organizing much of the pro-Russian political side of things through his own party, the Shor Party. Now, he was stuck in a long series of corruption investigations, mostly involving him stealing money from banks. So Alan steals all this money, the corruption police are on his heels, and he goes into exile. Of course, the Moldovan government is quite supportive of Ukraine. It's a very Western-focused government. It is one of the most supportive, I'd say, on all levels. Except, you know, financial, because it is quite a poor country. So we have this pro-Russian politician being chased out of town by very adamantly pro-Ukrainian government. This leads to protests by Alan Shor's supporters, calling for charges against him to be dropped, allow him to come back, and a proposal to make Alan the prime minister as a way of healing these wounds. This, of course, is all no. Like, that's absurd. Why would anyone do this? So on the surface here, we have this issue of a corrupt politician with the corruption police after him and his supporters having protests in his support. But then we go to the next layer, which is the national issue, which of course comes up anytime the Russians are involved. Now, while all these protests were happening for just these rather, you know, criminal corruption-based issues, we have Russian agents kind of kicking up other forms of dissent amongst the masses, including sending kind of these Russian imperialist activists into the Gagauzia area of southern Moldova, which is a kind of autonomous region of the Gagauz ethnic group. Moldova has two of these regions. Gagauzia is autonomous, and then Transnistria is just occupied by Russia and is a undeclared state, an unrecognized state. We've talked about it in the past before. I'm not going to go too far into that now. Well, in the midst of all this, then the Russian propaganda starts to come in, saying that the Moldovan government is about to kind of suppress Russian speakers, that they're attacking Russian culture. You've heard this song and dance before. Take everything Russia says about Ukraine, replace the word Ukraine with Moldova, and that's basically what's happening. To the point where even many members of the Russian government and propaganda arms thereof began to kind of threaten Moldova with invasion, saying, you saw what happened when Ukraine went down this route. Wouldn't it be awful if the same thing happened to you? Wink, wink. And this will also happen with Georgia in our next segment, so hang tight there. And then in the middle of all this, there's information that there was a coup being prepared, that in the midst of these pro-Russian protests, they would try to overthrow the government. And this has been evolving over the last few months into a more and more hazardous kind of situation, to the point where now the Russians are more or less threatening invasion through Transnistria, even though, as we've talked about in the past, that is basically impossible for them to do. And because of that, Ukraine has stepped in and basically said, if the Russians invade you through Transnistria, we'll help you out. As in, this could be, so if Russia threatens a broader war, Ukraine is willing to meet them and restore Moldovan sovereignty over the Transnistria region. So as we've seen, from what I started out with, we have this corrupt politician stealing stuff. And in defense of this corrupt politician stealing stuff, we eventually boil over into threats of outright war, including the airport in Moldova being shut down because there was a threat that it would be taken over by Russian paramilitaries. None of these threats really panned out yet, but like I said, the situation is getting uglier and uglier, and we just never know where it can lead to.
Though I do want to note that on a practical level, Russia doesn't have forces. I mean, there is technically a quote unquote peacekeeping contingent stationed in Transnistria. However, that contingent is a tiny, very poorly equipped, because why would you spend money equipping guys in an area you never have to think about? And are backed by, well, there are photos of the so-called Transnistrian military. And
no, I've been there in Transnistria. I've seen what they have. It's old Soviet stuff, even old by comparison to what the Russians are using.
And the soldiers make Dad's army look like a modern rapid response fighting force. The point is, on a practical level, it is difficult to see if Moldova gets even the slightest bit of support from anyone, including Ukraine, how Russia can practically threaten that country in any real way.
Yeah, the threat is more of this internal problem. Russia wants to create other conflicts around it in order to at least create the illusion that there will be a broader war, because that is the thing that the Europeans especially are very afraid of, this whole paranoia about World War III and all that. So if the Russians are making it look that, like, oh, if you keep falling down this road, it will lead to this broader and broader war that will kill us all. Moldova is an obvious link in that chain in order to make it look like they will spread the war, even while they are failing at executing the one they're currently working on. And this would mostly be through this internal political upheavals, through these weird financial corruption based vectors, and just causing as much trouble as they can on as little of a footprint as they can. And like, even these protests, one thing that stood out to me is they're interviewing one of these protesters and they're speaking to him in Romanian, which is the language of Moldova. They actually just officially changed the official language of Moldova from Moldovan to Romanian.
And there is no Moldovan language. There never has been. That was a Soviet era invention to basically separate Moldovans from Romanians. They have always spoken Romanian. That is the name of the language that they speak in Moldova, is Romanian. I remember when I went to Chisinev in 2015, it was, I sat down at a restaurant. I was there traveling with my grandfather, who was obviously grew up in the Soviet Union. He asked the waiter if they speak Russian or Moldovan, and the waiter responded that he speaks Russian and Romanian because Moldovan is not a language. Never has been a language. That has always been Soviet era nationality propaganda.
Yes, Stalin just said that it was something different. But anyway, they were interviewing some of these protesters in Romanian and they didn't understand what was being said. So when they then started to ask them questions in Russian, they're like, oh, are you from Moldova? No, I'm just Russian. So a lot of these protesters are not even local hired guns. They're just people shipped in from Russia, which, when this was noticed by people from Donetsk and Luhansk specifically, they were saying, oh, this looks exactly like what happened in 2014 as it unfolded in front of my eyes back then. So be very weary of this, Moldova. We've seen this show go on before. So Moldova, definitely something that we're going to have to keep an eye on in the future. It is a bordering country with Ukraine that shares many of the same dynamics, many of the same problems, the same enemy, surely. So we need to pay attention to what happens there, and we'll give updates in the future if anything more takes place. But with that, we'll move on to the protests in Georgia.
Now, Georgia, just like Moldova, went through a kind of Donetsk 2014 moment. Georgia went through kind of a Kyiv 2014 moment with a massive protest breaking out across the country, though especially in the capital of Tbilisi. And that is due to the Georgian government attempting to pass a law that is dubbed the Foreign Agent Law. Now, the Foreign Agent Law is something that Russia has had on the books for a while now. It basically dubs any organization that receives an X percent amount of funding from a foreign source. So that could be a grant from European democracy organizations. It could be a grant from USAID. All of those information, all of those organizations, it could, to be honest, in Russia, they've used it to smear organizations that receive Patreon as falling under this law. So basically, it makes all of these organizations that receive quote unquote foreign funding nearly illegal at best, and simply represses them outright. And again, this law is almost identical in language to the law that Russia has had on the books for quite a while. And what it mostly does, just like in Russia, is it serves to discredit civil society organizations and non-governmental organizations by painting them all as this nebulous, dangerous, foreign-funded thing.
Yeah, for the law in Georgia specifically, it's 20% if they receive 20% of their funds from an outside source. And while all it does technically is puts a label on these organizations, as you're saying, that label exists to discredit. So in Russia, what they had to do was, it became kind of absurd. So following some of these Russian news outlets, there would always be the disclaimer on their tweets, for example, saying that, say, Medusa or anything else, saying this tweet, this information is brought to you by a foreign agent who is working on behalf of foreign powers and they're bad or whatever, in these, you know, capital letters, block text next to the link. It looked, made them look untrustworthy. And that's the idea here. It is to take these, say some community center in the Georgian countryside wants to put on a play. And so the Georgian community of New York sends them money so the kids can produce a skit or something. Well, they're now a foreign agent. Or if a human rights group in Tbilisi puts on some kind of program that receives maybe a grant from the U.S. embassy, or even, again, like this, any foreign funding, government, non-government, whatever, now when people see that human rights group, they will then see the label, oh, this is a foreign agent working on behalf of a foreign government, just because they took some money. So I saw some people saying, oh, why is it such a bad thing to do financial reporting? Well, it's not. There's financial reporting in every single case. Like, it's just, I've done this kind of thing for NGOs before. It's all very transparent most of the time. And if it's not transparent, you can tell. It's not about that. It's about making this separate category and then, at once creating that category, be able to denigrate it, which is what happened in Russia and what they were trying to do.
However, the Georgians themselves were not having it. They immediately flooded the streets and began to protest against this particular incredibly invasive law. making anti-Russia statements, pro-Georgia statements, pro-Ukraine statements, coming up with chants, and they even attempted to storm the parliament building to occupy it. The Georgian government having lost, and when we say the Georgian government here, what we're really doing is referring to the ruling Georgia Dream Party, led by oligarch Idzina Ivanishvili. We've spoken about Ivanishvili on numerous occasions on this podcast. He is a pretty big figure in regional politics, of course, and he is very closely associated with the Putin regime in Moscow. So despite the fact that the Georgian government immediately deployed riot police, who began taking very heavy-handed measures to kind of repress these protests, it didn't work. And after about 2 days of these huge protests, Parliament dropped the law and kind of stepped back from their attempt to pass it. And I would also like to note, as Georgian commentators have said on social media, that there is a very good chance that the law was in fact unconstitutional, according to the Georgian constitution. Much like Ukraine, the Georgian constitution contains direct references to the European Union, in that joining the EU is a constitutional priority for any Georgian government, regardless of that particular government's ideological leanings. The Georgian state is constitutionally obliged to go for to take actions that would bring EU membership closer. And of course, a law like this was immediately criticized by the EU, with numerous EU representatives saying that if it does pass, it will threaten and likely lock out any chance Georgia has of joining the EU. So similar to how Viktor Yanukovych's refusal to sign the EU association agreement kind of violated this dream of Ukrainians of joining the EU, and that brought out mass protests. The same thing happened in Georgia. Georgians very much want to join the EU and are very much against any attempts to slow or take them off that path.
Yeah, the Georgian people as a whole are quite aware of the threat posed by Russia on account of Russia currently occupying two regions within the country, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, and are kind of slowly, you know, every once in a while moving the fence forward a bit while no one is looking.
And we do mean that literally. There have been numerous reports. Yes, there have been literal reports from farmers about how parts of their fields will just disappear because the Russian soldiers at night literally took the dividing fence between Russian occupied territory and Georgian territory and moved it a few meters into Georgian territory. In fact, there have been even a few reports of people losing entire houses that way, where one morning they wake up and they're suddenly under Russian rule and not Georgian rule.
Yeah, that is a very literal statement. You could fall asleep in Georgia and wake up in Russian-occupied territory. It's a thing that occurs. And there's, of course, the Russian invasion of Georgia that stabilized this kind of relationship between the two. There have been many Georgians who have come to Ukraine in order to fight the Russians here when they had previously fought them over there as well. The Georgian Legion is one of the more prominent foreign fighting units, and a large percentage of foreigners who have died fighting for Ukraine have been Georgians. And there's just a tremendous amount of cultural, political connection between these two countries.
To the point where, unrelated, but just to end this particular section on a nice note, I've had claims from friends who have visited Georgia and Ukraine that the Georgian food in Ukraine is actually better. The Georgian food in Georgia. So
that is, I
don't know how much stock to put by that.
That statement is not going to be the official statement of Ukraine without hype. You can't.
No, it is not. I'm just sharing an anecdote. Jeez.
Okay. We could start a war over that. But yeah, so the people of Georgia are very much European looking. So this government that has kind of been puppeted by this pro-Russian oligarch and is taking these steps that would undermine Georgia's ability to join the EU in the future. It creates this weird situation where the government accused the protesters of being pro-Russian sometimes.
They also accuse the protesters of being anti-church, which is a very common tactic used by Russian propagandists to kind of smear domestic opponents. Whenever domestic opponents say, oh, look at this bad thing that our government is doing, the Russian government usually trots out a couple of KGB priests and has them say, no, these guys hate Christ and the church.
Yeah, and the protesters were very clear that this was about, you know, their Western viewpoints. And like at one point they projected Slava Ukraini on the Georgian parliament, I think it was, some important building. There are many statements in the crowd where they very much saw this as an extension of the same fight against Russia that is also occurring in Ukraine. And I do have to agree with that characterization that they chose. This is a common enemy, just a different tactic that they're using in different places. And I'd extend that to Moldova as well. So just to put a cap on the segment about these foreign actions going on in nearby countries, this is all very much connected to each other. This is all very much the same problem, which is Russia and Russian influence. And the victory of any one of these bolsters the position of the other two. And although Ukraine obviously is the largest of these because it's a full-on hot war with thousands of casualties, it is still the same overall event as everything else. And to fully confirm that this is what is going on, the Russian government in various forms, including the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, as well as the head of RT, Margarita Simonyan, even went so far as to threaten Georgia with invasion because, in their own words, having any kind of protest against the government is an invitation for Russia to invade and kill you.
And finally, to wrap off this week's podcast, we just wanted to say a few words on behalf of Maxim Butkevich, who is a human rights activist who was captured in June by the Russian forces and was just this week sentenced to 13 years imprisonment by the Luhansk puppet authorities. Butkevich is a incredibly well-known figure in Ukraine. He has always fought for human rights, for refugee rights. He was one of the co-founders of Hromadsky Radio, which is was at one time one of the leading independent news sources in Ukraine, and just an overall kind of good guy.
Yeah, we have both worked for organizations that he founded various times. You worked for Hromadsky. Ukraine Without Hype actually started as Hromadsky Project. And I used to work for a bit at Zamina Human Rights Center. So we were both connected in some way to projects that he headed up. Yeah, he was accused of being, you know, this Nazi fascist because he was working to help refugees from Donetsk to settle back in free Ukraine, often Kyiv, where many of them did go. And he was also a noted anti-fascist. He was an anti-fascist activist. So him being smeared as a fascist is especially stinging because of that.
And mind you, and on top of everything else, Butkevich was a pacifist up until the full-scale invasion. Butkevich routinely denounced armed conflict as a resolution to anything, and he was forced to put aside that very deeply held belief to take up arms. And the Russian smears against him as some kind of neo-Nazi or just that, and quite frankly, insulting beyond words.
Yeah, so he'll be spending 13 years in prison, according to this ruling in the quote-unquote Luhansk People's Republic. So I'm kind of worried, because when this territory is retaken, he'll probably be executed, is my guess. Not to, you know, curse that or anything, but I can't picture the Russians leaving prisoners alive as they retreat.
Well, on the other hand, perhaps he will be on the top of the list for any prisoner swaps that may occur. The Ukrainian government is still working to conduct prisoner swaps, and they do happen. We had a pretty big swap just a week ago. So with any luck, Maxim will be swapped for some Mobiks and returned.
Hopefully.
And with that, that's our podcast for this week. As always, please remember to like, subscribe. You can subscribe on any podcast platform that you listen to us. You can follow us on Twitter at Hype Ukraine. And if you really would like to support this podcast and contribute to independent Ukrainian journalism in English, then please take a look at our Patreon and sign up to be a patron so we can continue to bring you and the world Ukrainian voices from Ukraine in English.
And I would now like to thank all of our patrons. So thank you very much to Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Giorgio, Ivana Kukratskaya, Michael Drucker, Anna Karen, Anonymous, Devi, Etene, Kevin, Michael Wickman, Sam Toman, Theo, Adam Poppenheimer, Hayden McDonald, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia, Barbara, Big Rob, Brianna, Captain Technical, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Emily Bavona, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jenny Louise, Jared, Julia, Justin Devendorf, Ken Shoemaker, Kristen Swanland, Laura De Leon, Levy Grove, Lottie, Marguerite, Matt Miller, Melissa, Mike Perrone, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Gengris, Scott Tukaruk, Steve Bien, Steven Greenberg, Stuart Akers, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Veronica, and Victoria Leontineva. Thank you all very much. You are what make this all possible. And I would like to remind that we also have a Linktree page that I'm putting in the description, and you can see on our Twitter, that contains information about finding other sources of information about Ukraine, and importantly, about various funds, charities you can donate to support the country, its army, and its people. So until next week, in the words of the executed Ukrainian soldier who inspired us, Slava Ukraini!
Heroyam Slava!